Leadership shouldn't be about who speaks the loudest, but rather who speaks the truest. I'm Charlotte Otter. Welcome to Speech Bubbles, the podcast that's rewriting the rulebook on leadership, communication, and success. In every episode, we're bursting the bubbles of traditional leadership, bringing you raw, real conversations with trailblazers who don't just challenge the status quo, they obliterate it. We're talking to heads of communication who know the power of words, HR mavericks reshaping workplace culture, and leaders from backgrounds that have been silenced for far too long. This is where vulnerability meets strategy, where authenticity beats artifice, where diverse voices don't just speak, they roar. Whether you're climbing the corporate ladder or building your own, Speech Bubbles is your roadmap to leadership that's human, powerful, and unapologetically you. Are you ready to transform how you communicate, lead, and succeed? Then let's burst some bubbles. My guest today is Jess Radd. Jess Radd is an award-winning speaker and entrepreneur and a leading UK voice on gender equity and neurodiversity in the workplace. She won the 2024 National Diversity Award for Gender in the UK out of an astonishing 90,000 nominations for her work within organisations and communities to close gender gaps, build allyship, and shift mindsets. In all her work, Jess always ensures there is an intersectional lens, and this comes from her own deeply lived personal experience as a late-identified neurodivergent woman, co-parent, and someone navigating premature menopause. Jess is founder and director of The Womanhood and works with organizations such as NatWest, the Open Society Foundation, and Sussex University. She is also an ambassador for AMAZE, a charity that gives information, advice, and support to families with children and young people with special educational needs and disabilities. Jess says, "The real challenges impacting the women in your workplace may not be the ones being spoken about, but that doesn't mean they aren't real, and it doesn't mean they aren't common. Getting outspoken about the unspoken has never been more important." Jess Radd, welcome to Speech Bubbles.
Oh, thank you, Charlotte. It's a real honour and privilege to be here with you.
Lovely to have you with us. So, Jess, it feels to me that getting outspoken about the unspoken is the theme of your career and your life right now. Why has it been so important to you, and why is it so important now?
I don't know if it has always been important to me. Maybe it was, but I didn't feel able to be outspoken before. It's definitely been an evolution for me, finding my voice, finding the courage to speak out about things. The last few years have been quite a challenge, if I'm honest. I found myself in lots of dark places and navigated what I would term, I suppose, a multitude of unspoken challenges. But they have taught me a lot, and I have grown and evolved probably exponentially in the last 4 or 5 years, really. I think I've really learned to tune into my energy to lead me where I'm meant to go. And when something really kind of lights me up, I've realized that's what I'm meant to be doing. And the more I've spoken out, the more, you know, feedback I get from people around me, but the more intuitively I feel like I'm in the space that I'm meant to be. In terms of why now, I guess this is the time. It feels like it's time. I feel very grateful to be alive in a time of great transition. We have had a menopause revolution, what's happening now. Neurodiversity is being, you know, ever so slightly normalized. And I feel like I've learned enough now, and it's time for action. It's time to be bold and get out there.
And that conviction that has come from personal experience, but also the culture, how are you helping organizations address the unspoken?
A lot of it is about reframing these challenges, I suppose, because lots of them are stigma. And that's why they remain unspoken, not understood, not talked about, therefore not known. You know, there's a low awareness amongst the people that are experiencing it themselves. And that leads to, you know, a lot of negative self-talk and repercussions on our daily quality of life and our long-term health. But it also means the people around us can't support us. So I guess a lot of my work is about trying to normalize and destigmatize these things, shine a light on them, and then increase the compassion, self-compassion or otherwise. And then we can look at advocacy, self-advocacy, or this kind of critical allyship, extending those conversations to all genders and making sure that we all recognize the benefits of change supporting everybody.
Yeah. And why are organizations wanting you to come in and talk about these topics? What's the drive for them?
Well, sometimes it's because they're losing people. You know, when in the case of menopause, they're losing senior leaders, and people will literally cite that as a reason for them not wanting to stay within the business. And of course, it's expensive to hire people. It's hard to find great people. And if you're losing often women, there's a multitude of reasons that we're losing women in organizations. But if people are waking up to realizing that there is something that they can do about it. So, yeah, I come in and talk about it. But often I'm finding it's even more important to create these safe and brave spaces where those people that aren't going through them can learn. So I've created a program, for example, about menopause, where perhaps counterintuitively, I actually segregate genders. I'm making sure everybody that fits between those binaries feels, you know, included, of course. But there are some sensitive topics that I touch on. So I still feel like it's important that we bring women and females, everyone with a womb, together to learn about it in a kind of a safe space, as it were. But crucially, bringing men together to learn about these topics without the possibility of them getting it wrong. I think that's the challenge a lot with these protected characteristics or just diversity at large, is that there's a hesitancy, there's a worry that people are going to say things wrong. And I think the challenge with that is that these conversations just stick within one group. And actually, if we want big societal change, we need to enable everybody to be part of it. So what I've found is when you bring just men together, and of course, every man knows a woman, that may be their partner or mother or daughter or their team, of course, that you can create that space for what often they acknowledge as ignorance, you know, and when you can create space for that, and then they can learn firsthand, secondhand, but often taking the stories directly from the women in their business and explaining this is how it feels, then that's when the kind of the magic can happen.
I love that concept that you're creating space for conversations for men separately from women to talk about some of these topics around diversity so that people feel safe, comfortable, not stupid, in a group of their peers, so that the conversation is both open but also empathetic.
Absolutely. Yeah, empathy is key. And that's why I do the women's one first, and then I literally take the lines, the anecdotes from that session, and put it in the men's one. And we'll say, you know, one of my favorite quotes is, perimenopause feels like I've been hit by a truck. That's how it feels, you know, or likening it, estrogen to oil in a car, which might feel a more helpful analogy for some. Like, it affects every single cell in your body, you know, so your whole experience of life. It's the same with something like neurodiversity. It impacts every element of your life. These are not little things confined to a certain part of our body or mind or life experience. They are full body and life experiences. So when you can help people step into the shoes of those that are experiencing it, and then it helps increase that empathy, as you say.
Yeah, I love that idea of stories opening up a space and a pathway for empathy. And now to your story, Jess. I'd love to hear a bit about your leadership career, your path. I know you started out in corporate and now you run your own business. Could you walk us through your leadership trajectory?
Yeah, yes, my background is in marketing. I've worked for Disney, BBC, 20th Century Fox. Every time I had a child, I changed my career, basically. And the businesses that I worked for started as some of the biggest in the country, probably, and then went down to, there was just a couple of us before I finally quit my job with nothing to go to. I think there was intuitively that sense that I needed to create something of my own all along, but a real reluctance, I think, to actually do that. My dad is an extraordinary human, and he is a bit of a serial entrepreneur, but he's also worked very hard to achieve all the things that he has. And as a mother and as a parent carer, having two children that have, quite high support needs, that idea of dedicating my life fully to work is how I understood getting to the heady heights that I aspired to. Didn't really feel very harmonious, I suppose. In fact, my dissertation, I worked at Disney when I did my dissertation as part of my degree, and it was on a deconstruction of the working woman, because at the age of 20, I was always perplexed by how I was going to marry my career ambitions with my desire to be a great mother, because I'm one of six. I also have an extraordinary mother who has always been there for us. So yes, for the last few years, I have been running my own business, which brings with it a whole different collection of challenges to overcome, probably more than ever before, actually. But my goodness, it's a journey that I love almost every minute of. And I feel exceptionally grateful to be in a position to be doing my ikigai. It feels like this is my purpose in life.
It's an amazing moment when you reach that. And you were one of my interviewees for We Need New Leaders. And I remember you saying to me that your business essentially started with getting women together, I think at the start of the pandemic, and telling stories about their experiences. Could you talk a little bit more about that?
Yes, the womanhood was born in 2019 when my period stopped. So I had gone from a 26-day cycle to 45 days suddenly without a period. And it was pre-menopause revolution. I hadn't only ever heard the word perimenopause once, I think. That journey ended up to me understanding within about a year that I was in premature menopause. But the happy catalyst of that was that it shook me to my core, I suppose, that I needed to make a change in my life. It felt like the universe had done everything to tell me that I wasn't on the right path, and finally it stopped my body working. So I quit my job with nothing to go to. And I ended up somehow bringing seven women together in a team of volunteers. We set a date of 6 weeks to put on an event. It was the start of the Unspoken Sessions. I was creating a brand, an event, a team, all simultaneously, really having no idea what it was going to become. And we sold out in 24 hours and brought women together to take a pause in their life and stop and think about these things that were impacting, as I say, their daily quality of life, which often have repercussions with our long-term health. And I wanted to create a space where they just could focus on themselves. And I also wanted to be a platform for amazing women that were doing this great work in their work life. So yeah, it was just pre-pandemic. It was in person. I had no desire to build anything online at the time. I felt like we were confusing digital interaction for human connection, because I'd built this other community accidentally of about 350 women where I live. And as that had grown online, the physical meetups had diminished. And so it had been perplexing me for at least a couple of years about how can I make it more purposeful to bring people together and actually do something that was going to result in them taking some action for themselves. And that's the kind of framework that has then been developed over time of knowledge mindset toolkit, because I don't think there's any point in bringing people together and just talking at them passive, and they just listen there passively. It's really about creating those new conversations, but also the chance for self-reflection. that silence actually is as important as those conversations that we're not having, like tuning in and listening to our own wisdom. That's what I try to give space to, not just in those community events, but also in the workplace. You know, that time, that introspection is something that's often overlooked, I think.
It's really striking me emotionally as you talk about self-reflection, because, you know, I was a VP in a global company. I ran a huge global team, and I feel like I was running, whether before the pandemic or during, from between 10 and 12 meetings a day. I was just all go, and there was no place for self-reflection. And then when I got home, I had 3 school-aged children I had to look after, also going through perimenopause, not sleeping particularly well, falling asleep, waking up and starting the day all over again, and just none of that beautiful space. And I can see how that is so effective for people to take some time to rest and reflect and think. So how do your womenhood sessions build in that reflection time?
Yes, as you were saying that, I was thinking about a few slides I have in one of my favorite workshops, which is helping women understand that their body is always talking to them. And often it may start as a whisper, you know, a bit of a headache, achy shoulders, oh, my digestion's not right, or I'm a bit irritable. And if we don't listen to the whispers, they get louder until they're a roar, and then you can't avoid them. And you end up with autoimmune diseases, or you're in hospital, or, you know, you have much bigger problems to deal with, which are happening all the time, really. And we're probably just not talking about it. I should know the stats, really, of how many people are on anti-anxiety and antidepressant medication. You know, there will be a lot. And so I give them a moment to tune into their body and say, what is happening for you? What have you been ignoring for a while? And I give them a few moments to think about that. And then I talk about your needs. And I have a big list of about 40 different things, from pleasure to joy to nature to connection, all sorts of things. And I ask them firstly to reflect on what needs are being met so that we can start with the positive. But then, which ones are you really missing in your life? Which needs are not being met in your life right now? And sometimes I have women that want to take a picture of them all, because they're just like, tick, 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 tick. There are so many. And because we are so brilliantly adept at putting other people's needs before our own, you know, we're socially conditioned to do that from a very young age. From a physiological level, we have a lot of estrogen in our body, which is our caregiving hormone. And that is making us want to look after people. That's actually vital for the survival of the human race. Otherwise, we would have babies and we just go and have a better time. Because frankly, yeah, looking after those kids is the hardest job ever. So that things are working against us. And of course, depending on your relationship dynamic, if you're in one, then that might not be working to your advantage, depending on your workplace culture and your boss and your man, you know, the leader of the business, how adaptable they're allowing you to, you know, flex your work and accommodate your needs. There's a good chance that basically you're at the bottom of the list. And what I say is, I don't know if you've noticed, but that list actually refreshes at the end of every day. You never get to the bottom. So if you're on the bottom, it's a false economy, because it's never going to work that you're actually going to find yourself, me at the top of that list. So what can we do? And then it's about making change feel accessible, because of course there's a million things that people want to change, but we have to talk about 1% changes so that we can get into action.
Yeah, talking about needs is incredibly powerful. I think that as women, as parents, as women in the workplace, I think we do push our own needs down and think about the needs of others. And it's a lovely moment when you hit menopause and you realize, oh, I'm allowed to think about myself. It's so liberating. It's fabulous. Jess, you look at everything through an intersectional lens. Could we talk a little bit about your intersectionality?
Yes, so I'm a half Persian woman. I'm a parent carer because I have children, as I say, who have additional needs and have required a huge amount of advocacy for the last 12 years, which is an area that I really want to continue to work on shining a light on. I'm also a solo mama. I don't like the term single mother. I feel like it has negative connotations in my with my branding hat on. I've rebranded that when I became that some years ago now. I do co-parent, but it feels, yeah, when you're on your own with your children at home, it feels pretty solo, to be honest. And I am neurodivergent as well. So I found out a couple of years ago that I probably knew a little bit before then, but I had it confirmed a couple of years ago that I am neurodivergent, ADHD for sure. And I'm quite sure I'm autistic. I'm on the wait list like many others. So, yes, that's a lot of different intersections and going through, yeah, premature menopause, which, as I say, has a huge impact on your life experience. And to be honest, I feel really grateful for all of those, because they make me the woman that I am today. They deepen my understanding of what will be the reality for millions of women out there. As Glennon Doyle says, one woman's story is a million women's story. So I feel, yeah, a sense of gratitude that I have these experiences and I have a voice that I've realized can be quite powerful, and I'm ready to shine a light on those that might not feel as able. And in fact, I have had that feedback. You know, I have had women that I don't know say to me, thank you for speaking up in this way, for speaking out for us. And that feels like a real privilege and honor.
Yeah, it's wonderful work you do. And I wonder, is it a coincidence that as we become more aware of perimenopause and menopause, we also are becoming more aware of what ADHD and being on the autism spectrum look like for women?
Well, it certainly speaks to all of the systemic gender gaps that we're always battling against. And, you know, we are the repercussions of not having had women in all the places that decisions have been made. So, you know, menopause has been happening since the beginning of time. But I think it was about a few hours training that a GP would get until very recently about the menopause, despite 51% of us going through it. And it's the same with neurodivergence, you know, that we didn't know until pretty recently, all things considered, that women could be ADHD, and the same with autism. And now, only now in the last few years, are they starting to do research about, yes, that intersection with our hormones, and realizing that as our estrogen declines, which is what's happening in perimenopause, that it is amplifying those neurodivergent traits. So things that you could have perhaps coped with, or you've masked, or were just laying dormant, are suddenly becoming far more pronounced. I was going to use the word intolerable, because that is how it feels, you know, someone going through it at points, that, yeah, you sometimes have to just take a pause and realize, wow, life is feeling really quite difficult right now. But and then the beauty, which is why I really speak to that increasing awareness of these things, is that when you understand why, that's when you can give yourself that self-compassion rather than, you know, beat yourself up about it, which I hear all the time, the self-flagellation.
Yeah, so the chance to actually think about the needs and to meet them. Jess, perhaps this is a lovely moment to talk briefly about the event series that you're going to be running soon in Brighton around neurocuriosity. Would you like to give us a plug for that?
Yes, please, because I have just sent the launch email today, so it feels really exciting for me. It's the first time I'm bringing back community events in 5 years, and that's really where my heart lies. And this time it is about autism and ADHD in females. It's called NeuroCurious because I really want to mainstream this conversation and shine such a positive light on the strengths of it. I feel there are so many people still hesitant to look for assessment or identification. I don't believe that a diagnosis is always critical at all. but they're on the periphery of these conversations because they don't feel able to step into it. And it's the same with workplaces. You know, they have these brilliant ERGs that are set up for all of those people that are in those world. But, you know, often the conversations I have with clients is, how can we get more people that actually really need it, potentially, that don't identify, that don't know it about themselves yet? And crucially, all the people around those neurodivergent individuals. I often say that the hardest thing about being neurodivergent is not knowing it. And the second hardest thing is the people around you not understanding it, because that almost kind of scaffolding, definitely the compassion, is really essential to kind of thrive, frankly, when there are certain things that are just intrinsically more challenging for you or can be misconstrued. So yes, this event series I'm really excited about. I've got a lot of partners on board, but it's going to be at a brilliant co-working space, Platform 9. It's a 70-person event. We're starting with looking at how it presents differently in females, but we're going to have the UK's first neurodivergent bookshop there. We've got a couple of book signings happening with brilliant authors, Andrea Anderson and Abigail Balfe, two brilliant books by autistic authors that I love. We're going to have unspoken stories from diverse bodies and minds. And I'm really hoping that we're going to have all genders there. We're going to make sure we're very inclusive for anyone that identifies as non-binary or trans. And I've got Joyfully Different there, who are a neurodivergent community. We're going to make sure the physical space is feeling really accessible. It's really exciting to bring people back together. And I'm finding there's a real appetite for that in-person sense of community as well.
Sounds like a wonderful event. And I personally, as someone who's neurocurious but doesn't live in the Brighton and Hove area, how could somebody like me access the event?
Yes, great question. So we're not able to live stream it for tech issues, but we are going to record the whole thing, and you can buy the recording now or afterwards. And the intention is it will be a series as well. So I want us to be afterwards looking at the intersections with our hormones and our health, because it does have such a big link, in our workplaces. And I really want teams to come to show their support, you know, of their neurodivergent, or more likely divergent, you know, plural, team members, or those curious leaders, or the people that don't have the budget necessarily for their, you know, own big EDI initiatives. This is going to be a cost efficient way for them to join in. In our families as well. So that, you know, a lot of neurodivergence is very heritable. And I'm going to be looking at that ND family connection and hopefully getting an OT, occupational therapist, who is trained in this to be talking about our nervous system, because a lot of it is about how we can co-regulate our children, which is not easy when you don't understand your own neurodivergence.
Absolutely, for sure. Well, I love to hear that it's going to become a series. That's wonderful. Jess, back to you. You're a leader, you're a founder, you're a public speaker. Since your nomination last year, you're a very public figure now. How do you think about your own reputation?
Yeah, I think I don't overthink it, to be honest. I don't think about it a lot. I guess it's important, but I always speak from the heart. I was going to say I try, but I don't try, because it's just the way I operate. I speak with honesty, at times a bit of radical candor if I can squeeze it in and it's allowed. I always try and bring optimism and positivity to the things that I'm talking about. And so as long as I'm out there speaking in a way that feels true to me, I feel like the reputation should follow.
It's amazing you say that, because one of my other interviewees in this podcast said almost the same thing. She said, if I act according to my values and my purpose and true to myself, the reputation takes care of itself, which speaks to an incredible amount of self-knowledge. But you also talked about bringing positivity and optimism. And to me, that goes to the use of language. So being thoughtful about language. And I know in our interview for We Need New Leaders, you said you learned from your father, who's a wonderful entrepreneur, that when communicating, the onus is on the sender, not on the receiver. How do you personally put that into practice?
Yes, good question. And I'm sure my dad will be delighted that he's getting a name check in here as well. So I think when I was reflecting on this the other day, I was thinking that I've often done a lot of mirroring. And now I'm wondering if it's actually part of being neurodivergent that we are so often tuned in to the other person, and that kind of camouflaging and hyper awareness of every little moment that you can see on someone's face as you're communicating is often really picked up by me. So I'm often, very hyper aware of those things, I suppose. I'm already tuned into how they communicate. You know, it's a bit like the love languages. We express love, we receive love in the way that we express love. And I see that as a similar thing with communication. So I think that's happens automatically. I often will try to make sure that people have understood me. You know, I can talk a lot. I'm an ADHDer. It's part of one of my strengths, let's say. And I hope that I make it easy for people to say, nope, I haven't got a clue. I don't understand what you're saying. So that if I have miscommunicated, there's the opportunity to say that without worrying about my response. And then I suppose I do try to take responsibility for when that hasn't gone to plan. And I guess that can happen. I suppose it happens, probably in my home life as much as my work life, thinking about it. My children need quite different types of communication due to their neurotypes and learning styles. So perhaps I've also been tuning into that on a really regular basis. That kind of self-reflection and awareness, I suppose, comes all the time as a parent. It's forcing me to think about how I communicate.
Yeah, I love that, because there's always been this big divide between working self and parenting self. And somebody I was speaking to recently said that parenthood, but more specifically motherhood, is a boot camp for leadership. And the way you're talking about how you communicate with your children, that you meet them where they are, seems to me to be really relevant for leading teams.
Yeah, I'm watching myself as I start to build my womanhood team, actually, over the last few months in particular. I can see how I'm using those skills, and I'm doing things in ways that were never done for me in my corporate life. You know, we literally have a one-pager, two-pager of this is how I like to communicate. These things are important to me. You know, I want you to be able to talk to me in this way. We have clear boundaries about when and which platforms, because work can get so blurred with our home lives. You know, you can end up WhatsApping people. And I'm finding it very liberating, actually, to step into owning how I need to communicate in order to do my best work. So, for example, sitting just full stop isn't what brilliant for me to work. I like to stand up and dance, actually, and listening to loud music to focus. But sitting and typing things in order to get an idea out, just doesn't work for me. I need to voice note it, essentially. And I've got someone working with me at the moment who is utterly brilliant, and she's really happy to hear my voice note and replay back, okay, these are things I'm going to do. She's also happy to voice note me a response, but because of a working memory challenge, which often accompanies ADHD, I'm not going to remember everything. So she'll also type the things that I need to remember or the actions for me. So it feels like we're just creating a lovely, collaborative, honest, innovative, creative way of working with one another. And I'm playing that out with all these other people as well and finding a true liberation with it. It's exciting. As my team grows, I really hope that, well, I don't hope, I know. I know that this will be how I do it. And I also intuitively know that it will help me attract the right people as well.
So what it sounds like to me is you're leading with empathy, and that empathy goes to how each member of your team needs and chooses to show up. So it's not only how to communicate with Jess, but it's everybody has their own paper of how I show up, how I like to be communicated with. And I think back to myself starting, in corporate at the age of 24, and how there were just no tools There were no tools of this nature. You just turn up and you conform and you fit in. And what you're doing and what you're making an example of, what you're embodying, is celebrating everybody's diversities, whatever they are, which allows each individual to show up and to shine in their own leadership, which I think is so beautiful, Jess. And as you know, my passion with We Need New Leaders and with this podcast is how do we, A, help new leaders find their way in order to land, keep, or create their dream leadership roles? And to do so, how do we collectively and individually get rid of those old leadership archetypes? So I'd love to know what you think we need to do to change the old archetype and to celebrate new forms of leadership.
For me, it's about being really open-minded and curious, just to not feel any sense of pressure to conform. And as I get older, I feel that less and less, and it feels more liberating every time I do it. But to, yeah, just because things have been done one way doesn't mean it's the only way, you know, and to embolden those younger than us as well, who will have new ideas and new ways of thinking, and creating the space for them to bring them. We have to really understand that communication is two-way, and the bit that we often forget is the listening. And how can we make more space to listen to new people that whose voices have maybe not been heard so much in the past? And yeah, really feel that sense of excitement to do things differently. I mean, when I worked at Fox, we would do any campaign we would do, we would look afterwards, and it was kind of drilled into me. What can we do the same? What should we do the same? But crucially, what can we do differently? And that's how I approach a lot of my work still, is how can we do things differently? In fact, it's just ingrained in me. I wonder if it's a neurodivergent thing. I don't know. But it's always striving to try and not do it for the sake of it, but just not feel held back in any way by what's been done before.
What strikes me as you're talking, that not being held back by how things were done before and trying to do things differently serves to unlock change and also unlock a sense of freedom for everybody to show up as they are. And I think that, you know, when you said listening, I kind of got goosebumps, because I really think, although you say you're a talker, what you're really doing in your career now is opening spaces for people to listen to other people, which I think is just so beautiful, Jess.
Oh, thank you. But I think it's that co-creation piece as well, right? It's not, leadership isn't, for me, top down. This is the way I want things to be done. It's how can we come together? How can we harness what you're brilliant at? What gives you great energy? How can we bring those things together? I don't want people doing things that's hard work for them. I want them to be doing the things that's easy and that's effortless, that energizes them, because I'm going to get the best out of people. And I say that frequently. Do you want to do this? Is this going to work for you? Because if not, let's find somebody else to do it. I think that's the best way. And it's, you also give people that sense of ownership, you know, then they're part of it. I want people working with me that live and breathe in what I'm doing. And surely that's what we want for all businesses, you know, for those values to be fully understood, but for you to feel like you mean something, you know, you're part of it and you've got some autonomy there. If you're just, maybe it works for some people to turn up and just do a job and go home, but the stories I hear, actually, more than ever before, is a great need for purpose. I'm determined, before the year is out, to create a workshop on finding your ikigai, because I see it in my personal connections. I see it in a lot of men, actually, in particular. And I see it in businesses. Or, you know, people come up to me in when I do in-person workshops. Oh, I know that I'm not doing what I want. And, you know, how have you come to create this? It's a need that we have as humans, but I think you also get to a certain point in life, don't you? And what I understand is that younger generations are finding this more, even more, and being more demanding about it. But yeah, there is a great sense of need to find purpose. And if we can build that energy into people's roles and let them co-create it for themselves, that feels really exciting to me.
It absolutely does. And now we get to the standard questions that I always ask. Give us a book recommendation.
Yes, I think I'm going to go for an old favourite, which is Feel the Fear and Do It Anyway, because I often have Dr. Susan Jeffers' words echo around my mind, and I have a little miniature version of confidence that sits in my bathroom so that I can pick it up on an early daily basis. Right, what do I need to channel today? But yeah, I read that book on and off throughout probably for the last 10, 20 years or something, and it's really stood the test of time for me. Not just about getting outside of your comfort zone, but also building a life that isn't too wedded to one or two areas, making sure you have a multifaceted life. So if things do go wrong in one area, you're not going to fall apart.
Lovely. Thank you so much. I need to reread that one. Jess, what are your three tips for emerging leaders who come from either diverse backgrounds or have diverse identities and are entering the workplace?
Get comfortable with being visible. It's one thing I hear all the time. I mentor and facilitate a lot of neurodivergent disabled entrepreneurs, social entrepreneurs through Hatch Enterprise. So it's often a barrier for them, but you're just going to have to do it. And the sooner you do it, the better. Secondly, don't be afraid to ask for and receive help. It's a common thread, particularly with women, I find. Well, I'm sure it's a lot with men. I just don't hear those stories. But the reluctance to lean on others. But I've learned that lesson the hard way, and it serves me well time and time again. And thirdly, have unwavering self-belief. You, with a diverse background, encounter a more challenging time in work and life. That is the reality of the current situation that we're in. But use that to fuel you and do everything you can to maintain that unwavering self-belief and bring people around you, but talk to yourself kindly so that that never leaves you.
Get comfortable with being visible. Don't be afraid to ask for help. And have an unwavering self-belief. Three fantastic tips. Jess, a last question. The world sometimes feels a little bit heavy at the moment. What's bringing you joy?
Movement. I love to dance. House, Afro house, techno. I love to dance. And my children bring me a lot of joy.
A lovely moment to end. Jess Rad, thank you so much for joining me on Speech Bubbles.
You've been listening to another production from Solid Gold Podcasts.